Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Imagine opening your morning paper to read the headline, 27,397 children have died. And you pause and think, I read that yesterday. And you look at the pile of old newspapers and sure enough, there's that same headline. 27,397 children died the day before, and it turns out the day before and the day before that. Well, do the math. It's estimated that 10 million children die every year before their fifth birthday, most from the kinds of diseases and bacteria directly linked to poverty. Now, many people find these numbers and this problem utterly paralyzing. Not Paul Farmer. For more than 20 years, he's been working to do something about it with colleagues from his organization, Partners in Health. He's been caring for thousands of people suffering from AIDS and tuberculosis in places like Haiti, Peru, Mexico, Guatemala, Russia, and most recently, in Rwanda. Paul Farmer's work is detailed in the best-selling book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, and he's here to talk with us today. And we'll pose a question to you that Paul Farmer often asks. Why is it that the needs of the poor and the sick are so often ignored? And when people in poverty die needlessly of disease, well, what then is the cost to the rest of the world, the cost of doing nothing? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Farmer's here with me in the Connection studio. It's nice to have you here. Thanks
for coming.
It's
good to be back. Thank you.
I'm interested in hearing about your decision to go to Rwanda. The figure that I was just quoting, that 10 million figure, comes from a recent report done by the World Health Organization, which talks about the unbelievable pressure on women and children in countries such as the ones that you work in, but I think also in particularly in Rwanda.
In Rwanda, more than any place I've ever been, the burden of these problems falls on women and children. And, you know, of course, if it fell on men living in poverty, as it does, you know, maybe I wouldn't feel any different. But it's really a struggle. And in that country, because of the, mass violence that occurred there just over a decade ago, in which some people estimate that between 60 and 70% of the population was killed or displaced, 60% of the entire population of Rwanda, when the dust settled, and, you know, it's taken many years to settle. In looking at Rwanda today, the majority of survivors are women and their children. And so they're surviving with the legacy of the conflict. And some of that legacy is, of course, excess disease, and AIDS particularly. And yet, you know, having been there, when one does go there, I think you can feel this determined optimism about making Rwanda different and better. And that's very inspiring. And, of course, women are the backbone of that effort as well.
The work that you do and the work that Partners in Health does is seen as inspiring by people right around the world. And I can imagine that there are daily, hourly requests for you and your organization to look at all these different countries. How do you decide? How do you choose? How did you choose Rwanda, for example?
Well, we're almost stunned, actually, still to this day, that we do get those requests so often. And when they come from a place like Rwanda, as they did and have for a couple of years, I have to say, for most of us working at Partners in Health, our first thought is, wow, you know, that's really, you know, this is a cliched term now, but it's really very affirming to think that after what they've been through, as they try to rebuild, for example, the health infrastructure and what they're trying to be able to provide to the population at large, that they would think about a small group like Partners in Health as partners. Because Partners in Health is big to us and maybe even to some of the listeners here, because, you know, it's supported locally and it's based here in Boston. But it is a small organization with limited areas of expertise. And a lot of those have been geographically focused, because the group has always worked very closely with communities that are, again, burdened by these problems, social problems, medical problems. So we have been working, say, for 20 years in a place like Haiti. And you derive a certain expertise from sitting still, listening, and working. And to have had the people in the Ministry of Health, for example, in Rwanda, pick up on that and say, well, these are the kind of people we'd like to work here, was terribly moving to us.
But part of it, too, would be your own reaction to what you've seen. And I know Rwanda is new to you compared to Haiti and Peru and other places where you've been for longer, but what did you see there? What about the people that you met that made you think, we can do something here?
Well, I remember I had a couple years ago, I was in Rwanda for a meeting. And meetings, well, there are a lot of meetings, a lot of conferences, a lot of consultations. And they get stale, as I think you'd imagine, because we have meeting after meeting about the 27,000 kids dying every day, the way you launch the program. And it seems sometimes that there are more meetings than any meaningful actions or interventions. And at this meeting that I went to, because it was held in Rwanda, I got to meet a number of Rwandan professionals, physicians mostly, and to hear their steely determination to make Rwanda a healthier place, and not to say, well, because of the mass trauma that has occurred here, we know we can't re-knit our society and make it a safer, healthier place. I heard none of that. I heard something very different. And, you know, instead of the world-weary bureaucrats, you know, that often show up at meetings, I saw in the Rwandans there many people who, if they had either survived themselves the genocide, and many of their family members had not, or they'd returned to Rwanda from exile, and they all seemed to be very committed to this idea of working for people living in poverty. You know, they didn't hesitate to use terms like that, across all boundaries of ethnicity and geography. It's a small country, and that was very amazing to me.
There's a woman that you quote in a recent essay that you wrote about Rwanda. Her name's Esther Mujaweo. I don't know if I've pronounced her name properly. She represents many of the widows in Rwanda. And you used a quote from her. She said, and I guess to you, if you have not protected somebody in 1994, at least stop her dying now, 10 years later. And I thought to myself, you know, that's such a powerful statement. But in many ways, it echoes exactly the same statement, type of statement, that you've been making for the past 20 years in terms of trying to get people to pay attention, whether or not it's like sticking a needle straight into the guilt zone or the shame zone or whatever. It's, I mean,
an effective tactic and one we're not above. Of course, someone like the woman you just quoted shouldn't have to do that. She shouldn't have to be pushed after having survived, in her case, rape. She shouldn't have to be begging for therapy for AIDS, which is one of the complications of what happened to her 10 years ago. And that's another thing that I saw a great deal of in Rwanda, and it struck me as very legitimate. And there's a certain indignation and also a mistrust, and I guess I should have been upfront with that as well. There's a mistrust of what we call glibly the international community, and I think it's very well placed. And so that and perhaps makes their overtures to us even more meaningful. These are people, many of them, who are quite aware of what, you know, the neglect, disinterest, or worse, the malignant interactions of the rest of the world meant to their own country. In agony, and so now have a pretty healthy skepticism about, you know, what it is we the rest of the world is up to now. And yes, we have been saying this for a long time, and we've been saying it because we've been listening to people like Esther and others in Haiti who are saying, you know, we don't agree that we should die just because we're poor. We don't think that our children should die of malaria unattended. And I haven't seen all this resignation that I keep reading about. I haven't seen it in the places I've worked.
Are you in any way feeling any closer to getting that message through to wealthy people in a country like this one, that people in Haiti or people in Rwanda don't need to accept lesser, lower level of health care? They don't need to accept some of what has become acceptable to those who could prevent it. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And I think that we're making headway. In a way, it could be put in a very, again, a grim fashion. We're making headway getting people just to listen to what is manifestly true. We're making headway in having people acknowledge that these conditions are abominable. But it could also be put in a more, you know, optimistic, chipper mode, saying, you know, finally people are starting to notice that there's a lot that can be done, and that they can be part of that. And they don't have to be an infectious disease physician. They don't have to be trained in international health or public health. Anyone can be part of this movement I'm hoping to avoid jargon buzzwords, but I don't know what to call it, global health equity, the idea that something so precious as health might be better viewed as a right than as a commodity.
But you got a lot of people who aren't paying attention. I don't know how you get through whatever you have to get through to speak to them. What do you need to say to them?
I think that if we were to accept, if someone like myself or people from Partners in Health were to accept the responsibility of making some of these experiences and stories compelling to people like us, people from a place like Boston or to a university or people who have benefited, that's our responsibility. We have to make those stories real to people here.
Connection listeners, if those stories are told to you, are you listening? Do you believe you can make a difference? Do you think that there is a level of sacrifice that in this country we've not really talked about when it comes to providing the level of care and assistance to people who are sick and poor at the same time? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Paul Farmer is here with me in the studio. We'll take your calls when we come back after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Dr. Paul Farmer is here with me in the studio. He is a specialist in infectious diseases, calls himself a medical anthropologist, which is a way of understanding how he connects the medical work that he does with the social work and the people that he cares for. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and we'd like to hear from you on some of the bigger questions of poverty and medicine and sickness and health and why it is that we could open the paper and read about 14 people dying of the Ebola virus, but we don't happen to read the story of the 500,000 mothers who will die in childbirth this year. And I don't know how frustrating that is for you, Paul, because, again, it's like the size of the numbers almost makes you want to turn away from it. It's only when we get someone like you, your eyes, your experience to tell us about one person or one woman or one place, you know, where it becomes real. Is that our failing as humans, that we need that kind of narrative to make it real?
I think that's a failure of imagination, sure. I think you're also right to call it, you know, human. I don't feel in meeting with people for whom this is a very abstract notion, I don't feel any, you know, maybe when I was younger, I would feel indignation. You know, how dare we not know about this? That has faded, and yet our commitment to these problems has not faded. So I think it's better to try and understand this as a failure of imagination that's very so common as to be almost universal. And I think that, again, just before the break, I was saying, increasingly, those of us working on the front lines of these struggles, whether they be in Boston, mind you, or in rural Haiti or in rural Kenya, part of our job is, even if we're subspecialist physicians dosing antiretrovirals or antibiotics, part of our job is to make this compelling to people who can make a difference. And, you know, anybody can make a difference. And obviously, if you're working in a place like Haiti or Rwanda or Kenya, you want the majority of the difference to be made by Haitians, Rwandans, and Kenyans. However, by accident of world history, you know, it's our country, it's this country more than any other that holds the fate of the world. You know, those in a grim-minded mood would say holds the fate of the world hostage. Others would say have just this disproportionate amount of influence and power in the world today. So what the American public thinks is very critical to the future of global public health.
Tell me about the stopover that you made in Kenya on your recent trip to Rwanda. This was I guess we could look at it as a good news story.
It was a good news story. At least it felt that way to myself and the director of Partners in Health, the person with whom I was traveling. And the genesis of that trip came actually from Haiti. There's a couple in Boston who've been very successful in business, who have become supporters of our work in Haiti and elsewhere. They're friends of one of the founders of Partners in Health, Tom White. And they'd come to Haiti, and I was there when they arrived. And they were visiting the clinical facilities and the inpatient areas and the village. And later on that evening, one of the two of them said to me, "Why aren't there more AIDS orphans here in rural Haiti?" And I said, "Well, because we take care of their mothers. We provide their mothers, the young women, proper medical care when they have AIDS so they don't die. And therefore, if your mother's there, you're not an orphan." And they looked at each other in the meaningful ways that couples will, and later asked us to go to Kenya to look at projects that they, as they put it, we were involved in some projects. We didn't know until later that they were supporting 6,000 orphans in Kenya on the shores of Lake Victoria. And they wanted to know more. You know, they'd never visited this project. They had been doing this. Again, this is what is moving to me. Not only did we not know the dimensions of their engagement, but they had never been there. So they had this empathy with these children without, like us doubting Thomases, have to go and see the wounds ourselves. They had done it on principle. And when we went there 15 months ago, we saw, again, it was very disturbing, and people should and many do know about this. We saw literally thousands and thousands of children and a lot of elderly people. But there was this missing generation, the parents, the young adults who have been mown down by HIV and tuberculosis and malaria in that area around Lake Victoria, where rates of infection have pushed a third of the young adult population, have really reached that high. So we went into people's homes, and we saw women, young mothers, who were dying of AIDS and being cared for by their children, not by doctors or nurses, but by their own kids. And
teenagers, little kids?
Sometimes little kids, 7 years old, you know, cleaning up their mother, bathing their parents, either or both of their parents. And we saw child-headed households where, a 15-year-old was obliged to drop out of school and take care of his 11 siblings and get them washed up and ready for school every day. He could never go again to school. And it was heartbreaking, Haiti's a tough place, and Haiti's heartbreaking in its own way. And certainly it's just as poor and riven by violence, more so, really, than this place in Kenya. But the patients in central Haiti where we work, they have access to this care. And so we were able to, in part because we were dispatched by our supporters who had been, again, quietly funding these projects, we were able to make some recommendations that, as we say in the States, that weren't rocket science.
You went back just
We went back
a week
last
or so
month.
Ago. Yeah.
We went back last month. And, to go into one of these houses where a woman had lain dying and cared for by her children and see her up and welcoming us with open arms in a spry manner, and whose biggest problem now was not that she was withering away and, had horrible diarrhea and couldn't eat because she had pain in her throat. Those were not her complaints this time. As she pulled out a chair for us to sit down and practically clapped us on the back, so, seemed happy to see us again, her big problems were, "I want to go back to work." And what it is, of course we said, "Well, what is it you do?" "Well, I'm a market woman, I sell fish in the market." And, so of course her problems weren't solved, and her kids are all running around. A couple of her kids also had AIDS and were on therapy. But to see that change in 15 months, that'll last you a while, if you know what I mean.
1-800-423-8255. Paul Farmer is here with me in the studio. We're going to Ashland, Massachusetts for our call from Milan. Hello, Milan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
I'm glad you called.
Dr. Farmer, I would like to thank you for all the wonderful work that you're doing in Haiti. Clearly, you call yourself a medical anthropologist, but we would have to do a research in the Plateau Central in Haiti to find out how the people of Haiti call you. And it's amazing the work you are doing, and I don't know how to talk about that. I have one question for you, though. I know that I've sent you many emails, so you may have heard about the work that the Heritage group is doing for Haiti, working with the grassroots people. And every time that I go to Haiti, I am so frustrated in terms of the bottom up approach to bring change in the country. I hear that...
What kind of change are you talking about, Milan?
Intrinsic change that would be... social change, reduction of the highly, deeply embedded poverty. Dr. Farmer said that he believes that the United States hold the fate of those poor countries, and I really feel strongly that I agree with that. However, maybe that is the question for another book from him. I really would like to know what is going to be done for different outcomes in terms of the country. I don't expect for the country to have the level of functioning of the United States.
Are you asking, Milan, what can the Haitians do for themselves?
Not just the Haitian. What can be done? Mm. It is clearly that it's going to take much more than just the Haitians.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for your kind comments about our work in Central Haiti. You know, we get a lot of feedback directly from the people we serve, and it's almost invariably gratitude, which is, you know, very nice for us, because we're doing, you know, even if we were not thanked so often as we are, we'd still do this work. But it's particularly nice for me as an American to hear Haitian Americans say the same thing. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. And I'm glad that you are also working on these problems. Of course, I understand your frustration. And although I live in Haiti and have for many years, I am an American, and so I won't pretend to understand the special kind of pain and frustration that Haitians feel when they see and know about the history of their country over the last 201 years, and the constant struggle to emerge from the template of a slave colony. And, you know, really in rural Haiti, often those terms are used, not necessarily template, but, you know, constant reference to what happened in Haiti, 200 years ago, and how it seems to many of the people we serve to be a continuous line of events and, you know, and processes that led to the current misery that you describe. And what is to be done is your question. And, you know, there are a couple ways of answering, more than a couple ways of answering that question. I think it is not a silly exercise to try and answer that question in a determined and optimistic way, sort of the sentiment I described to you from some of my coworkers in Rwanda. And that is, you know, if the answer to that question was there's really nothing to be done now, it's too late, there's no way to reforest Haiti or to stop the endemic violence or to halt the diseases that are, decimating parts of the population. But those would be false claims. It is possible to do something about each of these things. And as a Haitian friend of mine, a doctor who's been working on AIDS for over 20 years, he says, you hear a lot of bad news about AIDS, you hear a lot of bad news about Haiti, but let me give you some good news about AIDS in Haiti. And then he'll go on to tell you, as we will also, that the AIDS epidemic in Haiti is shrinking, not growing. That if the impact of some of the efforts that have been made there much more steadily and longer than in other countries in the Caribbean, some of these interventions are working. So it is true that the endemic poverty you describe is still the leading challenge for all of us, and that's what's leading, I don't doubt, to the violence there. But it's not true that we can't do anything about it, as you know from your own work. So in the what is to be done area, if we were to identify just a dozen things that are ranking priorities, and we could do that, it's been done, and had the resources set aside to do that, and had the latitude without interference from the, you know, the political disasters that are ongoing in Haiti, I think a lot could be done to move that country forward.
Milan, let me, if I can, come back to you. You, as Paul does, you get off the plane in Port-au-Prince, you get off the plane in Miami or Logan, and I'm, if you had one thing to say to people listening in who have not seen what you see, what would you say can be done to change? One, like, simple, basic thing, Milan.
Well, if I have to say just one thing, it would have to be, as soon as you get off the plane, I would like to see green. Mm. I don't want to see the head of those mountains. Mm. Last year, I went to a trip in Colorado with my husband, who is actually from there, and I was so overwhelmed with the beauty of some of the mountains, with the trees, and I would like to see a little bit of that for Haiti, because that's what that's what we would like to see to start with, when you just get off the plane, to have, because erosion causes so much problem, so much poverty, and then that could be one place to start. I know that there are a lot of strong international bodies doing work for health in Haiti, but the people of Haiti too, we have so many Haitian doctors who are unemployed, and if they were able to find a way to plug those Haitian doctors to small clinics, to small centers, so they don't have to themselves take to the sea to come to the United States, where they are going to definitely work in a different capacity.
This, Paul Farmer, is one of the things that you make a high, high priority in trying to do, to get Haitians looking after Haitians.
Absolutely. And, you know, our staff in Haiti, with a couple of exceptions I'll mention in one moment, is all Haitian. And, you know, we talk about the brain drain in a place up like Harvard, and think about personnel shortages and how they're crippling efforts to do work like this in sub-Saharan Africa and Haiti. But one of the ways, of course, to avoid the brain drain and keep Haitians, in charge of taking care of their sick fellow countrymen, the families that live in rural Haiti, one of the ways is to make sure they have the tools that they need to do their job. And, of course, a living wage. And, I just will say, from Partners in Health experience, we have very little attrition from our projects. We are now working with Haitian professionals who are running the projects that some of you have heard about. We've been working with them for a dozen years, for the community health workers for over two decades. They're not leaving. They're staying there and working. If they leave, it's to do some study and come back very often.
How many people work for Partners in Health in Haiti now? Rough estimate.
I should be embarrassed that I can't be sure, but it's been growing so rapidly. But I think there are 1,400 people working there. And I said, mentioned the exceptions. There are two Cuban volunteers from Cuba, one a surgeon, one a pediatrician, who are there on two-year stints as part of a Cuban aid program. And they're the only. We have a couple long-term volunteers who are Americans from Partners in Health, from the Brigham and Women's Hospital, from other places as well. But 99% of everyone working on these projects, they're Haitians helping their people. And
we've done pretty well in Haiti. We can relax now. But you don't, and your organization doesn't relax.
Well, the people we serve aren't going to let us relax. You know, to quote, I saw the one of the prime movers in this work in Haiti is a woman named Lun Vio, and I saw her being interviewed. Saw some tape of her speaking, and she was talking to a journalist who's off camera, he must have said to her, "But you're moving so quickly. You're spreading up. You're scaling up so quickly. You're spreading out so quickly." And she has an accent, and so their subtitles appear in English. But, of course, she was speaking English.
Right.
And she said, "You say we're moving fast. Our patients are saying, move more quickly. Move faster. There are people dying here." That was the end of that conversation. She just went on about her work.
1-800-423-8255. Paul Farmer is here with me in the studio. We're talking about the work of his organization, Partners in Health. We're also talking about responsibilities, or the responsibility of you listening, and how far people in this country would and should go to support this kind of work. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Paul Farmer is here with me in the studio. Many of you know his work from Tracy Kidder's best-selling book, Mountains Beyond Mountains. Well, the work continues. Paul is here with us for a short period of time. If you'd like to find out the latest about what they're up to and what is required of people to keep folks like Paul Farmer working in the field, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We're actually going to go straight to a call in Boston. Georgina's joining us. Hi, Georgina. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I guess I should start off by saying that the work Paul Farmer and Wangari Maathai, I'm sure you're familiar with her, she was a Kenya Nobel Peace Prize winner, is very inspiring to me. But in contrast between those two people, Wangari Maathai does believe in what pretty much Paul Farmer does, in believing that the people should be able to work for themselves and work for changes within their countries. However, being a little more familiar with Wangari Maathai and knowing some of the hardships that she endured, like overcoming political barriers and having to work through these infrastructures that are within these countries that make it so difficult for people to do basic things like, you know, receive medical care. How have you, Mr. Farmer, been able to just overgo all that, or have you had barriers, political barriers that you've had to face in these countries, in Haiti, and I'd be very interested to know in Kenya in particular. Is it just they just seem irrelevant to you? Do they just look at you as a foreigner part coming in, not whose laws of the country are not applicable to, and let you do your work?
It's a great question, Georgina, because local politics have been, I mean, in many ways, huge stumbling blocks for other organizations, less so for you guys.
Well, you know, I think, first of all, Georgina, thank you, because this gives me a chance to maybe even rectify the record a bit, because they have been huge stumbling blocks. And they have not, you know, our primary purpose as an organization, and now really more than one organization, because we work by establishing sister organizations in Haiti and Peru and Rwanda, Russia, in Roxbury and Dorchester and Madaba, you name it. We're working with organizations that we think of as sister organizations. Sometimes they have the name Partners in Health in whatever the local language might be, but they're run by our colleagues and friends. And we have had in each of those situations, each of those places, and even this city, significant political problems. Of course, in one place it might be, armed violence, it may come to having members of your staff held hostage, or having ambulances stolen, or threats, or being held at gunpoint. In some settings, that's the nature of the political problem. In others, it's bureaucratic red tape prevents you from getting, say, something out of customs that's really life-saving, that could save someone's life. So in no instance have we been spared, as a collective, those sorts of problems. Now, we don't focus on them in our work, in our public representation of our work. That's not why we went to Kenya or Haiti or Rwanda. It was, to take on those problems. But they're part of the healthcare crisis. They're part of the ecological crisis that was mentioned earlier, and that has really made Haiti so vulnerable to storms and hurricanes, and will make Rwanda vulnerable as well. Again, another agrarian society. So they're part and parcel of the problems that we face, and we know that. And I don't think that, we're not viewed as foreigners, because in large part we're not foreigners. As I mentioned, in Haiti, we have a Haitian team. In Rwanda, we'll be working with a Rwandan, and interestingly, a Haitian team, because our Haitian team is very experienced in doing the sort of work that we'd like to do in Rwanda. Members of our Haitian team have already been to Rwanda and are going back this month to help train community health workers. And so, no, I cannot say that we've been allowed to ignore local, either national or district-level politics. And it's been very difficult. And the more dramatic the the problems, the more likely we are to face political, what you call political barriers.
Georgina, thanks for that. Next to Anna, who's on the line in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Anna.
Hi. It's very nice of you to take my call, Dr. Farmer. I'm actually involved in a feeding program for AIDS orphans in South Africa, but I wanted you, if you could, to talk about the almost xenophobic suspicion that South Africans have towards the international community regarding, you know, their treatment or non-treatment of the AIDS crisis in that country.
Well, I think it's a critically important question, and it's one that we run into in Haiti and Rwanda as well, Guatemala. And I would just step back from the nation state in question first and then return to it by saying there's a general problem here that is not about South Africa. It's about the way the rich world, my world, the one I was born and raised in, and I never called it the rich world, of course, until I went to Haiti. I didn't understand very much about the way the world worked. But it's about the way those who do not have to worry about food, shelter, medical care every day, it's the way that we've responded, or not responded in some cases, to poverty, inequality, violence, epidemic disease in much of the world. And we haven't done a great job.
But it is changing in South Africa. You've got Buthelezi and Mandela in Zambia. You've got Kondo. These giants of those countries saying, "My life has been, you know, I've lost a son. I've lost family to AIDS."
Well, I guess I would say is in agreeing that you have major changes is how long will it take to repair the social wounds that are born out of things like apartheid or having the world either collude in a genocide in Rwanda or turn its back? I think it's going to take a long time. And I think the best way to get over what you call the xenophobia, which can be virulent, is simple and quiet service. Instead of having, public debates about, and I'm not suggesting that that's what you're doing. It sounds like you're not doing that. But, I don't know that having public debates about why, for example, mistrust of the international community isn't a good thing in Rwanda, I don't think that's going to be a fruitful debate because there's no reason for us to expect, and I'm going to go just focus on Rwanda and Haiti for a second, why should we expect the Rwandans and Haitians to think that our motives are pure and that we're there only out of the goodness of our heart when they have not forgotten history as quickly as we have. And in South Africa, and I was actually there on the way back from Rwanda to Haiti. As you can imagine, there aren't many direct flights from Central Africa to Central Haiti. And so I went via South Africa and visited some projects there as well. And, I have to tell you that in this very affluent African nation, to look at, a lot of the children I saw with HIV were not receiving proper care for their HIV disease, and even in some instances in hospitals that we would consider beautiful compared to what we have in Rwanda or Haiti, where there are the medicines for that could help these kids are just a few meters away, locked up in a closet, and some of the kids weren't receiving care. This is part of the legacy of what has happened in that beautiful country over the last century. And I think it's going to take people like you and me, and I recognize your accent is a little different from mine, Anna, but it's going to take a lot of effort, I think, just showing through simple service, humble service, that we're there for the right reasons or back there for the right reasons.
1-800-423-8255. Paul Farmer's here with me in the studio. We're taking a call from Waverly, Massachusetts. Philippe is with us. Hello, Philippe.
Good morning. I worked about 25 years ago in Haiti as a geologist, and matter of fact, in the same central plateau region where Paul Farmer has been also intervening for many years now. And as a young man coming from a rich country from Europe, from France originally, I discovered tremendous poverty over there. So obviously, I was shocked. But what I don't understand is that after so many years, it seems now, and in particularly with the AIDS epidemic, that so many poor countries in the world, in Africa in particular, and in Haiti, of course, are in fact perhaps becoming poorer and people are becoming sicker. So since so many ONGs like Poor Farmer Organization working in the field at the local level are really making tremendous improvement in health, poverty, and environment, I'm so puzzled why so little money and resources are funneled down directly from the UN, the World Bank, the US, Europe, and Japan.
Philippe, let's just take it away from the organizations and put the questions directly to the people who are listening to the radio, why there isn't more money coming from people who could give more money. I mean, is that an equally legitimate question? Philippe, are you there?
Yes, I believe it is. In other words...
The only reason I'm asking it is I was listening to Paul talking to Anna and saying that the service needs to be simple and it needs to be quiet. But, I mean, is anything going to change in this country if the message is quiet, or does someone need to bang their fist? Does someone need to say, no, actually, your quality of life has to go down a little bit if other people's quality of life is going to go up in any measurable way?
You know, I would say, Philippe, first of all, I'm gratified that there's a Frenchman on the line because, you know, as you were good enough to point out, you come from a very rich country that has its, you know, its hands deep in some of the histories, just as
right.
My country does, and both those nations, Rwanda and Haiti. And maybe you, like me, don't feel entirely satisfied by the way that our nation states, two very powerful nations, have comported themselves over the last couple of centuries. And even if we, the citizenry, do respond in the way that was just mentioned, and we need to, I think that's got to be central. In fact, the shouting that was mentioned is already being done by people living in poverty. They're shouting as loud as they can, and it's we who can't hear them. And you know that, I'm sure, from your trip to Haiti. People are very vocal about their social problems. So they're doing their job and saying, this is a problem. It's intolerable for us. It's unacceptable. And I think, you know, the institutions that you mention, they are key to the puzzle and to your puzzlement. You mentioned powerful nations like yours and mine. You mentioned the international financial institutions. And let me rephrase the question. What is it that we could do, those of us who are not formally in government or in one of the international financial institutions you mentioned, what is it that we could do to pressure these powerful polities, these bodies that have so much in their control? And I think that, you know, I shouldn't go off on an anecdote, but just
do,
stop me.
Go, no.
you know, a week ago Sunday, I was in Haiti, and it was a high holiday in Haiti. It was Easter Sunday, and I did not work in the hospital that day. I read a book about the abolition of the slave trade by Adam Hochschild called Bury the Chains. And the reason I read the book, and I think the reason that he wrote the book, was to be inspired by the notion of community organizing and the powerful impact that it can have. That means organizing people, you know, the citizenry. And in England in the late 18th century, this is a monarchy. There was no direct suffrage, really, to speak of. And still, hundreds of thousands and later millions of people in Britain joined in this movement to end the slave trade. And that was not, you know, out of economic self-interest. It was, you know, it was based on this organizing that brought to the attention of literally millions of people living in England and in the United Kingdom, which was an empire, just like the French Empire, just like our empire today, the United States Empire. It really brought more and more average citizens in. And they did things like boycott sugar. They signed petitions, which caused a great deal of ruckus in the Houses of Parliament as these giant parchments were brought in and proceedings had to stop. And I think that in order to move the institutions that you mentioned, Philippe, we are supplicants, it's true, but we also have to be pressuring them to do what's right. I don't think that they're going to do the right thing by the world's poorest countries and the world's poorest people without a lot of pressure from us. And as you mentioned, it's a stunning fact that there are certain countries in the world that are getting poorer and sicker in spite of the efforts of non-governmental organizations and local organizing, and that is going to require some of the large-scale changes that you mentioned. But what is going to cause those changes? I'm not sanguine about the possibility of the really powerful doing this without us pressuring them.
And is part of the finding an answer to that question getting them to address the question that you pose, and that is, what is the cost of doing nothing? What's the cost of inaction? Is that the way?
Well, that is a way that they've actually started. Here we are saying they. Let me be specific. If the CIA, for example, publishes a report on the way in which AIDS will destabilize countries in sub-Saharan Africa, as they did, and it was a very lucid report, I might add, I think we can count on excuse me, I'm supposed to push a button to cough, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I think we can count on the very powerful and certain institutions, to do the exercise of what is called very often enlightened self-interest. They'll do that. They'll look at the impact of AIDS, for example, on the mining industry, or they may do it tardily, but it is in their interest. And I'm very uncomfortable using the term "there" as if diamond mines are unrelated to us, or government institutions like the one I just mentioned are unrelated to us. They are related. So it's the they is also us. But that exercise has been ongoing now for some years. And I guess I would feel inauthentic pursuing that overmuch, that route of reasoning. And I think that many people are moved simply by the fact that there is unnecessary suffering in the world, and there's much that we could do to stop it, just because we think it's the right thing to do. And indeed, I think that's where in the movement to abolish the slave trade and to abolish slavery itself, the great power of that movement did not come from the arguments about it's in our self-interest to stop this. The great power of the movement came from people saying, this is wrong and it's abominable, and that's the reason it should be stopped. So too with AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, women dying in childbirth. It's not necessary. We have the technologies necessary to stop most of the suffering, and that's why we should do it.
Just because it's the moral right thing to do. Paul, I want to thank you for coming in.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you. And thank the callers. I thank the callers as well.
Paul Farmer, physician, founding director of Boston-based organization Partners in Health. You can find photos of Paul Farmer's work and links to his organization on our website. We're at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.